With your Amex card, entertainment benefits like special ticket access and pre-sales to select can't-miss events while supplies last, make every tap music to your ears.
Zuck.
What's going on, Spike? How are you, man?
Orange blue sky.
It wasn't until the other day you texted me, and I'm like, this is just it's almost like an email signature that you have with the orange and blue skies now.
Well, yeah. Disappointing. Two losses in a row. Both at home. And I'm coined a phrase. The struggle continues.
Well, that's why I gave you all the book. Y'all can kind of relax in the nostalgia.
Long-suffering Knicks fans. But a friend of mine, we both share a friend, and she hit me, you were in high school, and she hit me to this book, said, my friend wrote this book about the Knicks, and I think you should. I'm like, what? So we had not talked, so I found out who was the publisher, found out who was the publicity department, and I got a book.
You went into reporting mode.
Advanced report. I mean, excuse me, advanced copy. I got a book. And then, you know, we got hooked up. So it's just been the book is a revelation. I don't think you have to be a Knicks fan or a basketball fan to enjoy the cast of characters that this time period deals with the glorious Knicks team. Now, the first, I'm older than you, so I was 13 years old for the Willis Reed, Walt Frazier, Dick Barnett, Dave DeBuscher, Bill Bradley, Bill Hoskins, Donnie May, you know, Coach, Red Holtzman. So that was the first great team, which won two world championships.
Right.
The 69-70 team and the 72-73 team. And so the Knicks have not won a world championship this 72-73 season.
Right.
How many years is that?
40. I should be better at math than this. You put me on the spot for all these people.
But this team.
Yeah.
I mean, you really, I tell people all the time, you can't use the word if in sports. Mm-hmm. If somebody, the ball didn't roll the Buffner's leg, Scott Norwood did not miss four field goals, you know, but this team, it's hard, you know. First of all, you had Michael Jordan.
Yeah, he was pretty good.
The GOAT. The GOAT. For me, two GOATs. Now look, I'm not hitting anybody, but Ali and Jordan, to me, okay, are the GOATs. So this book, ladies and gentlemen, is really bringing back a lot of fond memories, you know, and heartache. I was right up in it, you know, I was right there at courtside, the world's most famous arena. And I knew a lot of stuff, but the stuff you got in this book, you were digging, you know, you dug. And so it was enlightening to see all the stuff that's going behind the scenes, especially in the front office. You know, power plays and this and that and backstabbing and intrigue. So I recommend this book for everybody.
I appreciate you reading that. What he was saying, one of my high school, I know I've got a lot of high school friends watching tonight. Tia Dillard, who I didn't even know worked for you, I guess she must have seen me. I guess it pays to retweet your own stuff and to tweet people's pictures of the book. But she put it, kind of brought it to your attention, and I guess you kind of sent her out there to go find it. So I'm happy that she connected us. But no,
I'm not, probably found out the book came out till
right
today.
And it probably felt like a betrayal.
The New York Times.
It probably felt like a betrayal. You're like, wait, a Knicks book came out and I didn't know about it?
Hey, you know, you were doing that undercover.
Well, I appreciate you reading it. It was a joy to write this thing, man. I know it's weird. I knew
let's start at the beginning.
Sure.
origin? How did this come about?
I wish I could be like, you know, it was a foggy night. And no, a literary agent hit me and said, we know that this will be a hit. We know a lot of people care about
what they said. What would be a hit? Say, can you?
The Knicks of the 90s, specifically because of what you just said. You said, how long has it been? It's been a while. And, you know, I think there have been a last 5, 10, 15 years now between the Red Sox and the Cubs and LeBron and the Cavs. It's been a while for a lot of franchises, but there's like this emotional outpouring whenever you get a team that finally kind of reaches the mountaintop, or when you get a team that hasn't
Cubs,
gotten
there. That was in 1908.
I know.
And the Red Sox was 1918.
The saddest thing, man, I'm from Chicago, so I mean, there were people, they were putting radios in the cemetery, like, so that their parents, grandparents, great-grandparents could hear, you know, the game seven in baseball, and the Cubs were playing the Indians. It's like, man, it runs deep. And I know for a fact it hasn't been that long for the Knicks, but it's been long enough to where people have been just waiting and waiting.
You don't think the second world championship team was 72, 73 is not a long time?
No. I'm just saying it hasn't been like Cubs long, but half Cubs long, which is still long enough.
Yeah, there was no professional NBA in 1908.
Right. So maybe it wouldn't have been that long. But no, I knew. I was very close to saying no to the offer to do the book. I did say no once.
And why did you say no?
Because, you know, it wasn't my original idea. I think I was telling you, you know, my dad passed a couple months before this. I was still trying to work through that mentally, spiritually. I had a day job that keeps me busy enough. I was teaching on top of that. And really, I knew it would be a lot of work. Like you said, you dug and you dug and you dug. It's a lot of work, and it's not, you can't.
But hold up. Because I don't want the audience to think that because something's going to be hard, something's going to take a lot of work, that you should run away from that. So why don't you fix this up?
Okay. It was going to.
There might be some young children watching that we don't want to give them the thing that you run away from hard work.
It was going to be hard work regardless of when I wrote the book, how I wrote the book, and what better project to do hard work on something than something that people are so passionate about it that someone in your position is going to look up and see that there's a book on it and send the assistant out the same moment, you know, go get that for me and tell them. I mean, you told me this. The Knicks, I mean, y'all know where Spike is any night that the Knicks have a home game. He's going to be right there where he always is. It was a Wednesday night on a night where the Knicks had a game. You sent Tia out to go get the book.
Not Tia.
You didn't send her out to go get the book.
Tia's in Chicago.
Well, okay, so you sent somebody out to get the book.
My office in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay. I thought Tia was here. Okay.
No.
All right. Chicago. Well, so it was, you sent someone to go get the book. And
Simon and Schuster.
To Simon and Schuster.
Manhattan.
And on a night where the Knicks played, you called me Thursday morning. And I'm like, how are you calling me, giving me a clip notes on my own book? He had already read it, even though the Knicks played the night before. I mean, you read it in one day, in like two sittings, because...
Is it page turn?
Well, I appreciate that. But that, to me, I would get... The other thing, too, there's something that you hold yourself accountable when you're writing a book, because, you know, my publisher, my agent were like, you got to tell people that you're working on the book now. I was like, why am I announcing it now if it's not going to be ready for 2 years? Because you've got to put the shark repellent out there. Don't let anybody else do the book. You got it now. And I was like, okay. And it was funny, but once you put it out there that you're doing it, it's like an accountability thing because everybody knows you're working on it. So I couldn't go a week, 2 days, 3 days without saying, I'm tweeting about Breaking Bad. I'm tweeting about watching The Sopranos. Are you done with the book yet, sir? You know, like I'm getting that tweet from everybody. It's like your parents asking whether you're done with your homework when you're just having any level of enjoyment. It must be what basketball players feel like. When they tweet about anything, they're like, wait, you're not a good free throw shooter. Why aren't you in the gym? So that was the feeling I had, but it's holding you accountable constantly. And that was motivation too. The fan base, just people that want to read my work, that want something to do. We were all rushing people to finish The Last Dance. So we got something to watch during the pandemic. This was the same thing for me.
And today, the book came out today, right?
It came out yesterday.
Yesterday, Tuesday, right?
Yes, sir.
How's the reception been so far?
I didn't think I would. I had tears in my eyes yesterday.
What? How so? Do tell.
Were they tears or tears? No, you know, I've told you about my parents, man, and when I said no, I was getting over the passing of my dad, and there were two things that he was really excited about in those last few years. He was a professor, a sociology professor.
Where at?
At a couple schools. He was mostly at UIC, University of Illinois at Chicago, and then the last job he took, he retired from UIC and went to UMBC. You remember the team that knocked off Virginia in the tournament, the 16th seed, at University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And he knew I was about to start teaching, and I had started teaching at Northwestern. He was super proud of
what
that.
What were you teaching?
What's that?
What were you teaching?
Graduate school journalism at Northwestern, and he was super proud of that. He was helping me put together my syllabus for my students. But then the other thing, too, that he always was excited about, he knew I was going to do a book at some point. And he would send me these ideas, sometimes not very good ideas, for books and everything. And so I know he would have been excited about that.
But did he know about you, right? I mean, before he made his transition, God bless him, did he know about the Nick book?
No. It was right. It was months after that. And that was why I initially said no. Part of the reason. So, okay. But I know
he... I'm thinking of the chronological.
Sure. So he would have been really proud. And I know my mom would have been. What's that?
Chicago Bulls fan?
No. This will run deep. I told you he went to University of Houston. I was born in Houston. My dad grew up in Texas, so might have been a Rockets fan. But he was one of those guys that adopted whatever city he lived in. So Bulls, he liked the Texas teams. I took him to the NBA Finals, the clincher, and was that 14 when the Spurs beat LeBron and then LeBron went to Miami? We were there for that. He touched the trophy, almost grabbed the trophy out of Tony Parker's arms. And the elevator security guard almost punched my dad. But anyway, he and my mom would have been really proud. My sister, the day that you and I connected, I guess the day before you and I connected, you posted an Instagram post of the book, and she saw it. And she called me. She was in tears.
She follows me?
Apparently. I'm not even really big on Instagram. So she saw that, and she just started crying. She called me just thinking about...
What'd she say?
She said... Mom and Dad, and then she just was a waterworks, but she was just saying, this is, we ask ourselves, I think a lot of people have lost their parents, ask themselves, like, am I doing enough? And you want your parents to know that they did well. And this is one of those things, right? Like, this week has been just super overwhelming.
I'm happy for you, and it's well deserved, because just, you did the damn thing, baby, you did it.
Thank you, baby. Co-sign from you. I mean, you're, like I said, you're Knicks fan number one, man. So thank you. I really appreciate that. But it's been an overwhelming week, and just so much gratitude I've got for everybody that's watching, that's ordered. The event organizer here is telling me, like, you know, that they're in the process of getting more books in because they've been selling so many of them, they can't keep them on the shelves. That's just emotionally, it's just overwhelming sometimes, but I'm grateful.
Well, I think that it's two things. I think that it is your artistry as a writer. And also, this Nick team is beloved.
Yeah.
And I'm not, you know, people, my wife and I, we've been married 29 years, and so we don't have these discussions anymore, but I always tell her that the reason why I read the sports page first is because everything that's happened in the world has come through sports.
A lot of them.
So I go to the Daily News and the Post. Mm-hmm. I just read the Post for the sports section. But to think that sports is just some men playing games or women, but so much change in the world has happened through sports.
Yeah.
I mean, fundamental change. Where'd the world be without a Jackie Robinson, or, you know, or a Billie Jean King, or Muhammad Ali? We go on and on and on of people. Great athletes, but also were more than an athlete and use their platform to try to change, you know, various, you know, not just the United States of America, but all over the world. So I never, I got this from my father, you know, who loves sports, that it's not just games, you know, it's It's special, and I know that people might, you know, the fan, what's, fan comes from the word?
Fanatic. Yep.
And if you don't follow sports, it's hard to understand how fans' relation between a city, the high school, college, whatever, but fan and their team. Mm-hmm. And even though, example, I mean, Cub fans are, you know, they're great. The Cubbies, you know, Wrigley Field. You know, they were terrible for years.
Terrible.
Horrible. But that's your team.
My best friend can relate with that.
That's your team. Fun, yeah. And the same thing with the Knicks, you know. People were asking me, like, when the Nets moved to Brooklyn, you know, the Barclays Center's four blocks away from my office.
Did they try to recruit you to be a Nets fan when they were doing that whole branding thing with Jay-Z?
They tried it when the owner of the Knicks didn't.
Oh, they came after you.
And then, like, the next day.
They came in the living room.
It was on Instagram, you know. It's like, you're down the block, be a Nets fan. I can't, like I said before, the Barclays Center's four blocks away from my office. I can't do it. I have no beef with the Nets. KD, love them guys. Harden, Kyrie, they can ball.
Sorry,
I love that jersey too. It says Ben Stott. I told him, KD owns me. He said he's going to give me a game worn. You see the one that says Ben Stott? Do it not. But I can't do it.
Yeah.
I grew up with, I was 10, I was at the Garden. May 8th, 1970. Game 7. The World Series game. I was there. 10 years old. Well, Frank, growing up in New York City, here's my guys. Willie Mays, Walt Frazier, Joe Namath, Joe Willie, and Ali. And to be honest, I got to meet all these people too. I was a little knucklehead, nappy-headed kid running the streets in Brooklyn. And now you, and then I get to meet these people who were my heroes. That's just crazy, you know?
How did this squad resonate with you? I'm curious. Because I mean, you and I talked about
this. It's my childhood and adulthood. Uh-huh. You know, early on, I said, Lord, if I ever make any money, I want to buy a brownstone in Fort Greene, where I grew up. I want to buy a house in Martha's Vineyard. And I want to get season tickets for the New York Knickerbockers. And in this book, you wrote that story about the night the Knicks is still today, it's still controversial.
Very.
How the Knicks, how come you didn't go with that? We'll talk about it later.
Yeah.
But anyway, the Knicks got the number one pick, Patrick Ewing.
Yeah.
And I was watching with my girlfriend, and as soon as, I mean, she probably wanted me to tell me that day, but she at least gave me enough love that she dropped the bomb.
She
broke up with me. She waited to the next, to the first pick. So she knew what I would be so downtrodden. And then I got the axe.
She broke up with you right after Patrick Ewing basically became a Knick.
That's and the next morning, I was online. Tickets went on sale. The next morning, 6 a.m., I was at like 4 a.m., and that's, so I've had season tickets since Pat Stewart's first year of the year. And so every year, I just move down.
And that's the dream, right? The decor. That's the dream.
I mean, growing up, I was sitting in the blue seats, right. Madison Square Garden, they call it the Blue Heaven. You know, your SGO card, high school. I didn't care, I was in the last row. I was just glad to be the world's most famous arena cheering on my team.
Right.
I mean, all this stuff, I didn't know I wanted to be a filmmaker till the summer between my sophomore, junior years in Morehouse College. So, I mean, to sit, and also, I'm not going to brag, but until you sit, look, I'm blessed. I understand that. And those tickets cost a lot of money. But when you sit courtside at the Garden.
Yeah. You gave me a taste of that a couple of days ago. It's not bad.
Courtside at the Garden and it's rocking. Oh, I'm telling you. When the Garden is rocking, playoffs.
Yeah.
You can feel the building sink, but it is bananas.
But that was a jealousy I had in writing the book, and I don't think it's the way I wrote it. I think it's.
You were in Chicago too.
I was in Chicago.
They hated Chicago Bulls.
I wasn't part of that. I don't care. But here's the thing: watching the YouTube stuff, which is a really powerful research tool for something like this, by the way, to just see how physically. I keep using the phrase physically oppressive this team was defensively and how they hit people. Watching the YouTube stuff.
And the NBA had to change the rules.
They had to change the rules. And the thing that gets me, when I don't have a damn who wins. I'm not a Knicks fan. I'm not a Bulls fan at this point. I was as a kid. Watching the starting lineups and just how loud the crowd is, I get goosebumps watching the starting lineup introductions from the 90s. Sometimes you lose some of that electricity that you would have felt back then, but
I'm glad they didn't knock down the Garden and just renovate.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. I wish I could have experienced that. And there, I do wonder.
You can't choose when you're born.
Yeah.
That's when you're born, you're born.
Yeah.
That's like, well, if so-and-so, this player was born in another and played another era, why even do that? You're born, you're born. I don't hear, well, if so-and-so played in this certain era, he would not. It don't work like that. You're born when you're born. And that's why, and I agree with Michael Jordan, who says, Mike's very smart. And he's really tried to stay afloat in this whole who's the GOAT stuff. And Mike, you know, MJ, he said, it's different eras. You can't compare. And, you know, he said, I'm not getting that argument.
He didn't have to.
You don't have to.
He didn't have to, but number two, it helps to drop a 10-part documentary and let that be your freestyle on it and not have to. Right? Exactly.
But those don't know.
Exactly.
It's called dropping a mic. Dropping the motherfucking mic.
Why are you a best man?
All I can say is I got 6 rings.
Right. There doesn't have to be much.
It works. It works. It works.
It doesn't have to be a
breaking the mic, dropping the mic. Got 6 rings.
Yeah.
And never lost.
So that was probably the question.
The finals are never lost.
The question I got from the people, and the question I still get, a lot of people will tweet me and say, should I buy this book? Do I need to buy this book? I'm not a Knicks fan. Will I enjoy this book? You said, I think you could be a basketball fan and like it. I don't think you have to be a Knicks fan, but I think
that... just to cut real quick.
Yeah.
Even if you hate the Knicks, and a lot of people in Indiana did.
Sure.
Chicago and Boston, buy the book. And L.A. Because the Knicks were there. I mean, they were there.
And that's the thing. And that's the
just
thing.
Just can over that hump.
Because my thing, they're, and I think this was the NBA's hope, and I don't think Michael cared about, but I think the NBA's hope with The Last Dance is that there were so many people I would see. I follow a lot of fans just to understand what I should be writing about, what they care about, and they were like, damn, Michael's kind of good. Like, I didn't know he was like that.
Well, I think those are people who are too young.
Right, of course, and that's my point, is that
they got to see Michael play.
That's what I hope comes across in the book a little bit, is that there's so many people that are of the mindset that like, well, why should I care about something that doesn't involve a team that won a championship or that even if they got close, they didn't win it. But the thing is, when this is the argument, I guess I'm not making an argument, but I think you can kind of read between the lines of what's in the book.
Hey, can I just, I'll give it for example. One of the greatest sports books ever written. One of the greatest sports books ever written by Roger Kahn. the boys this summer about the Brooklyn Dodgers. He only once won 55 every year, you know, losing to the Yankees. They hated the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
And just the character of those, Jackie Robinson, Campanella, Joe Blatt, Duke Snyder, Carl Furillo, Pee Wee Reese. I mean, the characters, because it's human beings who are playing this game.
Right.
They're not robots, and everyone's not the same. And when you get this, you know, for me, what makes great teams are the characters where you have the mixture of the seasoned veterans with the youth. The Lakers example of a team that's old as fuck. No disrespect. They're old.
Y'all are real old. No disrespect.
Hey, look, I'm 63, so 64 really. I'm old.
So.
And you look at Golden State. They got them. They got them young boys. Them young. You guys are killing. To go along with
Stephen,
you know, Stephon, and that plays back, and Brother Man, who's out now,
Draymond.
Yeah, Draymond. So it's that mixture, and also people come from different backgrounds. Even all the black, I mean, even just because it is all black, I mean, everybody's from the hood, or there's different. You know, first of all, black people not one monolithic group, and if motherfuckers can't get along. And somehow find like put all the bullshit aside. We got to come together. We got to win this motherfucker. That's where greatness comes. Where whatever the differences are, whatever beast people got, that shit got me squashed. And you gotta have like motherfucker like Michael Jordan say, "Yo, fuck the bullshit. We're trying to win." And so I don't want to hear. We got to win. So all that petty shit that you motherfuckers doing, I'm not having. And you gotta have the alpha dog, like, yo, we're rolling like this, and like, you know, let's go.
I wanna ask you, based on what you were saying about these guys, you've said it before, you've been on record saying Starks was your guy. Sorry, you wear his jersey.
No, Patrick's my guy.
Okay.
But think about it, but I only wear game worn jerseys.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And a Patrick Ewing game worn jersey.
Big ass jersey on you.
It would come down. It would come, I got a frame now, but it'll come down right above my Jordan.
You and a couple friends could fit in there.
So.
Okay.
Starks, my guy too. Starks was responsible for me not moving from New York
right.
City.
Right, well, I figured
game
that.
Game six in Indiana.
Okay, because that's what I was going to ask you.
Because game five, I was on the morning after game five, I was on the front page of New York Newsday, now defunct. The Post and Daily News. I was on the front page.
Yeah.
Being blamed for the Knicks losing.
Yeah.
And nobody thought the Knicks were going to win game six in Indiana.
Yeah.
And Starks saved. As my mother, my late mother would say, she saved my narrow black ass.
What do you hit, five threes that game or something like that?
No, we came in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, just killed it.
Because ushers, late in the game, ushers surround the court with rope to keep people from storming the court.
Yeah, that was bad. That atmosphere, and it was crazy because I mean,
in the book I said that I'd never been to a Klan rally, but that was close to it.
Right, and the crazy thing is that I planned to quote that all along, but I was like, I gotta find something to kind of corrupt.
I said that in
the documentary.
Reggie Miller versus New York.
Right, you said it in the doc, so I knew you'd said it, but I'm like, all right, I want to try to go a little. That was what I was trying to do with the book in a lot of spots. Is there's stuff out there, but let me try to go one level deeper because there's been so much stuff about the Knicks or about those rivalries, and so in that case, it was something simple. But you read it. And J.A. Adande essentially said, no, I saw Spike come out of the restaurant. I saw them calling him the N-word. So it was pretty visceral. Yeah. It was pretty nasty. I mean, that's obviously.
And that, you know, Indiana is really just the South. The Klan was found in Indiana. So it's like,
man, you lucky. If they had us on ESPN, man, they're going to commercial break. But
we're on ESPN?
No, I said if we were on ESPN. No, it's the Strand. Y'all are
wrong with the Strand.
NC-17.
I got caught, and the players will tell you.
They heard it.
You go to Boston, and we know what they did to Patrick when he was in high school.
Pretty ugly. Real ugly.
Patrick put up signs, can you read this? You know, that kind of stuff. So now they don't, today the players don't play that. But back in the day, you would think that your nickname was the N-word. You go into Boston, you go into Indiana, Utah too. The Jazz?
Yeah.
Come on now. Yeah. Them guys, they'll tell you.
Yeah. It's sad though, because you get people that'll deny it and they'll say, I haven't heard it. Okay, but why would they have said it to you? You know, the way the fan base looks, you're not going to hear it if you're not someone of that background. You know, the players would know. And the players have literally no reason to make that stuff up. But yeah, there was a lot of that. And part of what, it wasn't that long ago, but part of what I noticed too in reporting the book out, and this has come out in the Mouths of the Palace documentary, we've been talking about that a little bit, I watched it. How loosely people called folks thugs. Like, you couldn't be a physical team back then without being called a thug. It came off people's lips real easily back then, off their tongues real easily.
Look, it started, God rest his soul, you know, David Stern, airbrushing Allen Iverson's tattoos off the League magazine, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And, rap, gangsters, violence, you know, it's that whole narrative.
Yeah. And the fact that the league, the dress code, you go down.
The dress code was definitely.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, that was like.
Carmelo and I would talk about that when I was on the Knicks beat, because he was one of the guys kind of at the forefront of that, too, with the baggy clothes and everything. But it was the league. I mean, that was something that came across, too, in the reporting in the book, is just. That was part of why they wanted to wash the Knicks out the way they did as far as their playing style, is that we've got women and children watching this. We can't be knocking Michael Jordan to the floor. We can't do that. You know, that it was essentially what they would tell me, and they would kind of own it. They said, look, we weren't doing that to the Knicks. Maybe the Knicks were at the forefront of what we were trying to get rid of, but it wasn't. I mean, we were more worried about teams trying to copy the Knicks and everybody trying to do that.
Bullshit.
Well, this is where you as a fan versus me. I'm just reporting the facts. I'm just the message.
That ain't a fact.
I'm just reporting the message. Maybe not the fact.
A fact is different from a message.
True.
You know words. I know you teach your students. Your girls are students at. So come on now. The Knicks were targeted.
And I don't think it's funny. I thought the league was gonna no, we were never doing that. They didn't even bother. I thought that's what they were going to say. They didn't really run away from that characterization. What they said, and I actually think it makes sense. And Doc Rivers and a couple other guys from that era said it made sense to them. They didn't like it, but they basically said, we don't want the league to become more, we don't want the balance to become more about physicality and toughness than we do about skill and athleticism. So
what about the Detroit Pistons, the Bad Boys? They went 3 rings.
They did. They had. But let's not get it twisted. They had a lot of talent too. I mean, obviously they did. With Isaiah.
They didn't have talent.
They did. And now I don't think they had as much. We could have the conversation.
Where did the Bad Boys come from? What does that mean?
The name, the nickname.
Right? Yes. Bad. The Pistons were known for their physicality.
No, I'm not. Nobody's denying that. I'm saying they had a lot of talent to go with it. That's all I'm saying. I mean, they had a couple Hall of Famers to go with it. That's all I'm saying. The Knicks had Patrick. We know that. Everybody else, you had Mace. You had Oak. You had Starks. You had one guys that were all-star one time.
Isaiah, who else is a Hall of Fame?
Dumars. Yeah, I mean, Dumars was a bad man. He was good. And Michael said for years that was the guy that – he said him, and I think he said Rolando Blackman, interestingly enough, which I never really thought of him that way. But
as what?
Guys that were tough for him, just to get around and score on and stuff like that. But Dumars was bad. He was a good guy.
Defensively. He was nice.
He was nice. So I do make that difference, but I did think it was interesting that Riley, there were some people that came in thinking, Riley's going to come in and make this Showtime East. And, I mean, we can look in hindsight. They didn't have the personnel to do all that. But defensively, he said, look, I'm not all that mad at what the Pistons were trying to do. Like, that strategy kind of works. They might be a little too old to carry it out, but that might be our best shot too. We've got some guys that can be bullies, and we've got a little bit of offense. We got Patrick. We can work around that.
I don't know. I would use the term bully. I mean, they were a physical team.
Yeah.
You know, and the physicality was to wear down and you know, make the other teams not, you know, be not wanting to go to the hoop.
At all. Even Michael sometimes. He didn't want to.
He didn't want none of that.
The Knicks didn't want to in practice. They were Stark said, I'm not going in there. It's one of the first pages of the book. He said, I saw the first couple minutes of practice. I said, I'm not going in there. They would rather shoot jumpers than go to the hole and get baskets, you know,
in practice.
And practice. They had to tape up for shoot arounds. Riley was on a different level with that. What did you feel when he left? Did you kind of feel like it was time? Were you upset that he was leaving? What did you feel as a fan?
I just didn't like the way he left.
Okay.
You know, it was. If I had been a player on that team, but he just like abandoned the, you know, the captain left the ship.
Yeah. Good team. I mean, best defense in a row, 3 years in a row.
He wanted, look,
yeah.
You know, some shaky shit maneuvering behind the scenes. He wanted to get ownership, some type of ownership of the team, and it was thinking go for Western on the Knicks now with Cable Vision coming in, and they wouldn't give it to him, so he was like,
yeah. Which I can't.
And you know, it was shaky because he was still in a contract. So wasn't there some joint draft, they lost some draft choices and they got fined or something like that?
Miami?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in hindsight, I think they paid him a million and they gave up a first. I'm like, that's all. That's a good trade if you're Miami. You take that trade.
It should have been more than that. $1 million. That's like nothing.
I know. The way we think about money and draft compensation is a lot different now, especially for someone of Riley's caliber. Because he was widely viewed. I mean, at that point, Phil had won a couple titles in a row. But I think people could still look at Riley and say, at worst, he's the second best coach in the league, if not the best. I mean, he was the only one that could demand an ownership stake and somebody take him seriously.
How many rings did you get?
Four. Four as a coach, one as a player. So four there. Almost got one with the Knicks, which I think everybody looked at the Knicks and said, maybe not the most talented team. They had a lot of skill.
What's that word you said? Almost?
Almost. It, like that if word you used a minute ago.
We almost won.
Almost. And that was, I will say this for people that are younger. I mean, I'm younger, so I wasn't of age, but 94, that's as close as you can get to winning a title without actually doing it. I mean, because they had the chance in game six with Starks. Kim Olajuwon blocks that shot. Starks had made six shots in a row leading into the end of the game on that last play with 5.5 seconds left. Hakeem gets maybe a fingernail on it to change the trajectory of the shot.
Yeah, the pass was open.
He was. I don't blame Starks. If I'm Starks and I've made six in a row, I don't blame him for taking that shot. And Patrick had really struggled. Patrick was open. But he wasn't. He wasn't.
Let's be honest.
Yeah.
And I love Patrick, Georgetown.
Yep.
But Elijah had his number.
He did. I think that's why Starks took that shot because you look at those numbers for the finals. He really struggled.
I disagree. Starks taking that shot had nothing to do with Patrick. You just said he has.
Starks has hit six shots in a row.
I know. That's what I'm saying. He's not thinking about Patrick Ewing. I'm hot. I'm taking a shot.
That's what I would have done too.
Yeah, but why are you bringing up like that? You'd say that Starks was saying that Patrick wasn't doing well.
No, not that Starks said that. I'm saying, like you said, Patrick wasn't doing particularly well in that series. He didn't have anything for Hakeem in that series.
What?
He didn't have anything for Hakeem in that series. Offensively, he just wasn't really getting it done.
But it started in college.
Yeah, that too.
The finals.
Yeah. Patrick was, so he struggled. I mean, it's tough because he,
look, the team wasn't, Patrick was the only one that it came to work on.
Right.
I mean, listen.
The game was bad.
No matter what, Packers might got.
Yeah.
You know, but King was a monster.
Yeah. How'd you feel about those late 90s teams? Because they were in the picture, too. They didn't quite get there. They had the shot in 97 and then the Miami, that whole Miami thing. I imagine all Knicks fans still feel a certain way about that. By that point, it was a little different. You had Larry Johnson.
Yeah, but that's another thing. That thing definitely could have been suspensions.
Yeah.
But Patrick, what, 1 foot over the line and get suspended?
Yeah. Did you feel like, in that case, did you feel like the league just was coming down on the Knicks just to prove a point? Probably most Knicks fans, by the way.
Yeah, he did. I think that David started getting blown down by something. Here's the thing I wish you brought up in your book. NBA headquarters is in New York.
Yep.
So they really have to do more to show the rest of the league that they're not, you know, giving preference to the Knicks. And the more complicated the thing is with the Knicks getting Patrick Ewing, and number the first time they ever have the lottery.
Right. Haven't won the lottery since then either. And they've been in the lottery a lot of times since then.
So
yeah,
the first time's the lottery, Dave the Butcher pulls out the thing and Patrick's name.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to get into it because Mr. DeBush is not here. None of them are my guys.
Right.
But they took a lot of, the league took a lot of flack for that. So it seemed to me they bent over backwards sometimes to show they were not favoring the New York Knicks because they're both from, they're both from the offices is blocks away from Madison Square Garden.
Right.
And New York City is the biggest market.
Right.
So I think they overcompensated. And the Knicks, you know, bore the brunt of those decisions.
Yeah. Were you telling us that we've got some questions that we're going to take from online?
Yes. Yes. So we do have some audience questions. Our first one is from Barry Goldberg, who asks, who was to blame for the Pat Riley resignation? Riley or the Knicks? We tend to rightfully blame Knicks ownership for a lot these days, but it also seems like the same type of mismanagement and ownership instability played a role in the fallout.
You want me to take you one thing?
You wrote the book.
I'm going to put that on my profile. I wrote the book, so people can't question me on what I say. My honest answer to that is, I think that Riley, to what Spike said, Riley has to own blame for how it happened. I think one thing that's overlooked in all this is that the Knicks were corporately owned during those years. And so it wasn't just as easy as saying, like, sure, Pat, we'll give you 10% of the team, because it was a corporately owned team that had shareholders and
board members.
You can't just give away 10% of something that is owned by a corporation. Meanwhile, the benefit that the Miami Heat had, Mickey Arison was coming in by himself, basically him and his family, to own the Heat. So if he does want to give away 10%, at this point it's probably 20%, because there was an additional 10% that he had to give Pat over the life of the contract he signed. He could give away 20% of the team. So they could do something that the Knicks couldn't. But Pat, as Spike said, Pat had another year left in his deal. And, you know, in fairness to Pat, I think people can understand when you're leaving a team for something that's going to be multiples of what you're paid in New York. People get that. It was just kind of, I think most people, Knicks fans certainly would say, like, a kind of a slimy way that he did it. But
they gave him hell the first game back in the Garden.
Yeah. Now that was another one.
He got holy hell.
Yeah. I saw a YouTube video from that night. Michael Kay, when he was doing stuff with MSG, was interviewing people in the arena. He interviewed a kid. A little kid about this tall. He said, I think Pat should go to jail. It's just like, it was ugly. I didn't realize how ugly that was, but I think Pat owns that part of the blame, or has to. The Knicks, I think the Knicks maybe could have been a little bit more aware of what was happening and that recognized that Pat was growing emboldened. to look for ownership?
How could he know if he was having these meetings just when he's not supposed to have them? There would have been no ramifications.
True, but
the buying and the draft picks if the shit was legit.
No, good point. So maybe not, but I don't know. I feel like they didn't write off Pat wanting ownership, but I think the tone in which he was asking for it should have signaled that something's happening. Maybe they could have, if they had caught wind of it before, maybe they could completely nip that possibility in the bud before it happens. My honest take, and I don't know if I told you this the other day when we hang out, I don't think Pat could have lasted much longer as the coach anyway. I think he was going to need to move into management or something, because he was burning himself out as far as
just burning players out.
He was burning the players out. Now I think they missed him when he was gone. Like, his first game back, the crowd wasn't having Pat, but Patrick and Harper and Starks would go hug the guy on the sideline. So there were guys, and they missed his style of coaching, but Pat was burning himself out in a way that I don't think, particularly in New York with the media and everything, it didn't feel like he was going to last as a coach. Maybe ownership or a piece of ownership would have changed that, but go ahead.
All right. Our next question is from Victoria, who starts off saying, congrats, Chris.
Thank you.
So excited to read the book. Who was the hardest interview to secure, or what was the most surprising thing you learned in an interview?
The most surprising thing, so I don't feel like anybody was particularly hard. Some of the people that were hardest to secure were the people that were like worked as secretaries and people that worked behind the scenes, because they're like, how the hell did you get my number 30 years later? And these aren't people that are like public people. So they're like, how'd you get my number? Are you a real person? Who are you? So I had to, you know, I put in the acknowledgments that people that used to work for organization were starting like Facebook groups to basically talk privately about like, is this guy legit? Is he just looking for dirt? How did your conversations with him go? And so I had to work to build people's trust. Some of the lower level people in this book, but I appreciate that they grew to trust me. The hardest detail to uncover, maybe not the hardest, I think the most interesting one, we were talking about this a little bit, that I don't think had been out there, maybe just people knew it privately, was the idea that Starks had the really rough game 7 where he shot 2-for-18 in 94. And essentially, one of the people Pat could have subbed in that situation was Rolando Blackman. He didn't, and nobody knows why he didn't. You know, Pat has never gone on record specifically saying
why
he didn't.
Oh, I'll tell you why.
What?
Rolando Blackman had promised his wife that the Knicks make the playoffs, that she come where the series was in the game 6 or 7 were in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And Pat Riley told the team why it aren't involved.
Right.
And I don't know what happened, but Alon's wife did not come. And therefore there were some discussions. And Patrick made the decision he was not going to play Rolando Blackman.
Right.
And Rolando Blackman told me this to his face, that he felt that he could hit some shots to make the Knicks have won game 7. And that would have been the third
Knicks championship. Right. So to me, that was the
But in the book, you say, what does Patrick, I mean, what did Riley say about that?
Riley, he's called it the biggest mistake he ever made.
Right, let's say so. That happened right away.
Him saying that didn't come right away?
No,
I think it was one of those things where in the moment, I think he owned it because he was going to be meeting up with Rolando. The Mavericks, years later, what was it, 06, when they played against the Heat? In the finals, Pat at that point is still coaching. So he was being asked a lot of things about Rolando because Rolando was on the other sideline. And Pat
he was still working. He wasn't playing.
He wasn't playing.
He was working for the
he was working
front office for the Dallas Mavericks.
Right. So to me, that was probably the biggest detail where I was like, oh,
that's not story before.
No. And I don't think people outside. The funny thing is, I think you, maybe you weren't in that circle, but you were in that circle. So the players might tell you stuff.
I heard about it, and then I called up Rolando. I said, "Yo, my brother, blase, 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 blase. So he confirmed it. I think I can't remember where I heard about it, but I wanted to talk to Lon and say, this really happened. And
right.
He says, Spike, if I played, I'm not quoting, can't remember the exact words, but I would hit some shots.
That's basically what
he said. Off, and we would have won a world championship.
That's essentially what he told me when I interviewed him. So there's still some hard feelings over that. I know a couple of the players I talked to suggested that they all kind of felt like that was a factor. And it's interesting because in my mind, I don't necessarily see it that way, that that's exactly why it could have been. But the fact that, to me, the reason I included it in the book.
Well, the reason why we're on the block and not play.
He hadn't played the rest of the series either. So that's all I'm saying is, like, unless it's something where he's really putting his foot down saying, like, you're never playing again. To me, it's feasible. He wasn't playing that much. He wasn't so much a part of the rotation anyway that, like, he absolutely benched him because of that. But he could have. And in that moment, if you're ever going to use a backup, you're going to do it when a guy is shooting 2-for-18. So I would have understood. And I'm open to the idea that that could have been why. I'm just saying, to me, even though I didn't see that as the reason, the fact that the players thought that that's why he might have held Rolando Blackman out, because Rolando said, we want to bring our wives, and Pat shut him down and said no, and then Rolando kind of went back at him and said, why not? The players thought that. And to me, that's more than enough of a reason to include that, because they know Pat's mindset better than I do.
I mean, I was surprised to read that in the book, because as you said, nobody knows, you know, that story.
People let me in, and I feel grateful that folks trusted this guy that, like I said, they're like, who are you? You know, and I think calling 30 years later, it does raise the question, like, why are you writing about this now? But y'all care about this. The fans still care about this stuff a lot.
The players care.
The players care. The coaches care. I've got so many texts from the coaches.
A great documentary, Malice in the Palace. And Reggie Miller's crying. It's like, tears in my eyes. Like, 18 years, and this bullshit happened, and that team, he said, whoever wins in between Indiana and Detroit is going to win the major. And then Detroit destroyed the league.
Mm-hmm.
And look, I'm one of these people that I don't think that just because you don't wear a ring, you know, that just destroys your whole legacy.
Right.
But at the same time, Pat's my guy. You know, I love him. That's my guy. Barkley's my guy. And you have these guys who were great, and they just, for whatever reason.
Yeah. I know.
They didn't get it. You know, they didn't. Karl Malone.
I know.
Stopped it. And in the way I think, that does not diminish.
You know.
How great they are. You got a lot of bums, not bums. You got people that rings.
People
that, you know.
You cleaned that up. You cleaned that up real nice.
They just happen to be on the squad. You know, without reason, they got a ring.
Yeah. That's why this book to me, man.
Can we use the word? Is this Shakespearean?
I thought you meant my book. You mean the story of the Knicks from the series.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm not Shakespeare. This is my first book. Don't give me all that credit. You know the literature better than I do. I'm not that sort of writer. But, like, I don't think that they ever went in. I don't know that they were ever viewed as, like, the favorite. Maybe once. Maybe one year. They didn't fall from that height. I think they had the chance to get it done. And so maybe you can do it.
But that even makes it worse, where you had the chance and...
Yeah.
And then, 2 years, Michael was not playing.
Yeah.
That's when you got to win.
Yeah. The first two times they went to the finals.
We stepped out. The second time, went to play baseball.
Yeah. Look at when they went to the finals, 94 and 99, immediately after he retired each of those first two times, which tells you how close this team was, but how... You really got to make that count, particularly in 94, because I don't think they're going to win 99 without Patrick going up against Twin Towers and David Robinson and Tim Duncan. You're not going to win that. But 94, they had a legit chance. Even with Patrick not playing particularly well, they almost won it. So to me, the reason they're so relevant.
Don't count.
It doesn't count. To a lot of people, it does count for this book. And I think the reason it does, I can't think of many teams that changed the course of the way the game was played more than this team did. given that they did not win the title. Like, to me, and it, I said it to someone on a podcast the other day, they looked at me like I was crazy. I said, I think this team changed, dictated the way basketball would be played far more than the Bulls did. Now, the Bulls were the favorites. They were the best team, the best player. They're the team that's going to be, you know, exalted in history. We get that. And they should be. No one's taking that away from them. But this team, they changed a ton of the rules because they could not have this in the sport anymore. They decided, we can't have this. We don't want this. And, I mean, they got them out the paint.
Who's dead?
The league. I mean, they own it. I mean,
the association.
The association. And whether it's because of what you were saying about the idea of, like, we can't, you know, we got to keep a distance from the Knicks so that people don't think that we're buddy-buddy with them, you know. I think legitimately, you know, whether you think it's that, legitimately I think that they said the league is getting ugly in a way that we don't want it to as far as the physicality. We don't want someone to get hurt. We don't want Michael to get hurt, whether it was protecting him. I do think there was a lot of that. I do think the Knicks were at the forefront of that, but they're the last that I've described them as these hard hat wearing prehistoric dinosaurs, basically, because you're not going to see that again. It literally, that you might as well put them in a museum. You're not going to see that again.
If you blow on somebody, you get rigorously get a flower.
Right.
Today.
Right. By the way, being at the game with you the other night, Ben, seeing you work the officials, you talking to the players, it's like an out-of-body experience being there with you.
Wow, what was I saying to the ref?
What were you not saying to the ref, bro?
Was I yelling? I wasn't yelling.
I wouldn't say you were yelling. You probably would have yelled if they'd been within. They were down 20, so I don't think that you didn't have to be as passionate about it because they were down by so much. If it had been a one-possession game, maybe. But I had a blast writing about this. I'm in awe of how much you cared about it. It surprises me that you, not that you care about it, but that you reached out and that you do an event with me on short notice.
Thank you for writing the book.
I couldn't be more grateful.
Everybody buy this book. Come on now.
And I think we can wrap with just one final question.
Sure.
And it's from Patrick, who says, Chris, I love your work. One of my favorite things is your ability to find the quirky stories surrounding the game, like Melo's on-court cussing or bats at Spurs games. What's the quirkiest story you heard writing this book?
The quirkiest story I heard writing
the book. Remember, there might be some children
watching. Yeah, I had to think about that just writing the book. I'm like, I gotta keep it age appropriate. The quirkiest story I heard, it was one that wasn't true. I've told this a few times. Did I tell you about this? I was so excited because I'm a political science major and a history buff. I really care about that stuff. And someone high up told me, the Knicks were in the middle of a long home winning streak, like 20-game home winning streak, and Richard Nixon was coming to a game. He wanted to take his grandson to a game the year before Richard Nixon passed. So I think this was 93. So Nixon's there, but the Knicks lose. And, you know, before the game was over, the Knicks do this now, where they get a big celebrity there, you know, in that case, a former president. They say, we really want you to come to the locker room, come take pictures with our players, come talk to our players. They do that sort of thing now. You see that now a lot. So Nixon comes into the locker room, but the team is kind of like not in the greatest mood because they just lost for the first time in half a season at home. Patrick Ewing is well known. Any reporters, people that, you know, they could get in the locker room, would always sit there with his legs out, stretching his legs, but he'd have his feet in ice. Big bucket of ice, you know, ice packs on his knees. And so he gets up. I mean, it's a process for Patrick to get up because he's such a big man. Nixon's there. He's getting up to kind of, you know, to pay respect to the former president, the disgraced president.
Tricky Dick.
So he gets up, and Patrick apologizes to the former president. This is the way the story is told to me, and I'll explain that in a minute. He gets up, and he says, we're really sorry. We normally perform much better than this. We're really sorry we couldn't get it done for you today since you're here in attendance. It was, you know, special to have you here. Richard Nixon grabs Patrick by the shoulder and says, you don't have to apologize for anything, Patrick, but in the future, if you can't beat him, just cheat. And So my eyes get real big when I get that anecdote in my interview, and I'm like, oh, really? So as soon as I'm off the phone with this person, on my computer, I'm firing up Google, because again, I'm a political science, I'm like a history person. So I'm like, I'm thinking, and I'm also thinking like, not necessarily dollar signs, but like the interest in the book is going to be broader than basketball at this point, because like you have a president that essentially had to step down because of dishonesty and cheating and different stuff like that. And he's like, he's telling a player and a team to cheat, like obviously in jest, but still, like that's an incredible revelation. It took me all of 5 minutes, maybe 10, to debunk the fact that it ever happened, because Richard Nixon only went to one game. You look in the media reports, there's only one game. And the Knicks won that game by like 25 points against the Timberwolves. So I was really sad when it wasn't true, because I was ready to build a whole chapter around that. Not really, but that would have been really quirky, really funny. It would have been a great history note to have in there. And like I said, it probably would have been interesting to a different audience, but it also was a good lesson to really vet every single thing that everybody was telling me. And even though it was a really prominent person in the organization that had told me that, I asked him, I said, where'd you get that from? Because I'm looking it up. I didn't see that. He's like, oh, I could have sworn somebody told me. I was like, wait, you didn't see this happen? So again, a really good lesson. And when you talk to 200 some people, you've got to be really careful you have to be careful about taking anything that somebody tells you as fact. You just have to investigate it for yourself. So probably the weirdest, quirkiest thing that happened. I wish it had been true, but it wasn't.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for such a fantastic event. It's an honor
to have us.
Spike, thank you for doing this with me, buddy. I appreciate you.
You.
Thank you. Thank you guys for tuning in.
All right, Knicks fans, orange blue skies. Let's go.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.